Today, we're talking with Kevin, one of the co-founders of Co-Architecture. Co-Architecture is a fantastic platform for architects, even homeowners or others looking for architects, as well as builders and others. I look forward to seeing how this platform continues. Let's jump on in and hear this interesting story about Co-Architecture and what it's doing for the industry. Welcome to the podcast. Today, we're talking to Kevin, who's one of the co-founders of Co-Architecture. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here. And to be fair, it's actually one of my first podcasts. So,
Well, there we go. And I mean, you know, it's quite interesting. I mean, you've obviously got a fascinating background, and what you're doing is exceptionally fascinating too. So I think somebody had connected us for some mentoring and some things like that. And then obviously I'd been watching your platform for the last few years. We actually started our businesses around a similar time as well, so it's been fantastic to see how you've grown within that time, and then as we've been involved in different things, understanding a little bit more of the purpose of Co-Architecture. Now, as somebody works with a lot of architects, there are some who know and some who don't know about Co-Architecture, and I think it's a great platform for architects, but also recently we even used it for ourselves for a house renovation. I saw your new owners part and where people could actually get in. I felt like that was a fantastic time for us to have a bit of a discussion about what you do and the story behind Co-Architecture. So let's jump on in. So tell us, Kevin, a little bit. Obviously, you're an architect yourself. Tell us a bit about where this whole vision of Co-Architecture came from.
Yeah, it's, I mean, my background is trained in architecture, about 12 years in practice. I started out in engineering and then moved into architecture and design later in my career. And it kind of began as a bit of a response to my own professional career and development. It was partly from recognizing a lot of these gaps in terms of opportunities, working within studios, but also potentially building one's own studio. And then the challenges of navigating that as a small business, it's very stressful and painful. So I'm sure a lot of other small businesses can attest to that. And it was a bit of a research project combined with personal experience between myself and my co-founders, Luke and Mike.
Right. So obviously, you know, one of the things that I've sort of noticed is, and you talk about that, so we work with a lot of people across the industry and different business types as well. The fascinating thing about architects is that majority of the businesses are small businesses, and there is about probably 5,000 to 10,000 architecture. Now, that's a very wide bracket. There's probably about 10,000 architecture firms across. It depends how much you go, because some people are, you know, just have registered, but they're still working for somebody else. It's sort of a business, but it's not really. But there are lots of, it's when people start to kind of make that transition to, okay, do I go and work for somebody or do I work for myself? Or, you know, like these collaborations and JVs and partnerships that other architects can do. So tell us a little bit about what Co-Architecture is for anybody who doesn't know what it is and who you help and what you do.
Yeah, definitely. I think Co-Architecture at the core of what it is essentially a professional network. People can think of it almost like a marketplace, but I would probably push more towards a network or community platform. And it's designed for architecture and design professionals to try and help them with more opportunities or gain more visibility and telling their stories and their brands across different channels and things like that. So as you quite rightly mentioned, majority of the industry is made up of small businesses, and it's means that the market as a whole is highly fragmented, it's highly competitive, and there's just not a lot of great resources out there to help those businesses grow or scale or whatever their business goals are, go out and achieve them. And so we came up with this idea of how do we create a shared resource that businesses could tap into when and if they needed to. And the concept was, what if it was a network that could provide that resource? So whether it's something to do with talent or outsourcing or contracting work with small businesses and collaborating with others, whether that's building brand or marketing and visibility and awareness for your business as it grows, or even our latest features, as you mentioned, helping find opportunities with clients or residential projects. So yeah, that's where we sit.
And it's quite funny. As I said, I've seen it over the years, and I think it's been great. I think one of the things that I've noticed is how good the approach is of actually having a forum for architects to also be able to publish their projects as well, and that marketing sign and being able to get it out. I know somebody from Melbourne, I knew they were very excited that their house had actually made it listed on Co-Architecture and they could show it around. So I think the thing is, whilst you've built a platform to help designers and architects, at the same time, it is really hard when you think, I want to build a house or I want to do this. Do you know an architect? Do you not? You know, where do you go? Where do you find one? Let alone when we hit, you know, industry downturns like we've had in the last few years, it's really, really hard for graduates to be able to get opportunities. And it's one of the hardest things for me is when I meet people and I go, you're so talented, but right now people just aren't hiring, and I'll give them strategies to be able to do that. And I know that's one of the programs, was one of the first programs that you set up. So do you want to talk us a little bit through about, for example, the graduate program and what you do and how you help people within that?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of that kind of story or journey in Co-Architecture probably, it ties back to where we kind of essentially launched. So we started working on Co-Architecture way back in 2020 when COVID was kind of rife across Australia. But
you're in WA, so I think you had.
Yeah, we were pretty safe in WA, but the time was perfect in terms of creating this kind of idea and resource. We just had no real understanding of how to build a platform or a startup, and we were fortunate enough to get accepted into an alumni program for small businesses through our university. And that was kind of really the incubator that helped us flesh out what we should do and how we should do it. And that kind of gave the legs to the idea and went from there. So 2020 to 2021 was really about figuring out how to build it and figure out who our first users were going to be and things like that. And so, by nature of being a tech platform or a community, generationally, I think we quite easily attracted young professionals or graduates who are coming into the industry. They're quite tech savvy, and they're always looking for new things and innovation. So I think we naturally had a good draw with uni and using our alumni networks and just the kind of genuine interest from young designers was exciting for them. And so from the very early days, like 2021 onwards, we always had this strong graduate cohort that was behind the platform and wanting to test things out. And so even though they weren't potentially our ideal customer who we were targeting or focusing on, they were always very supportive and active. And as we built the platform out, a lot of the resources and tools we were focused on at the time were around resourcing and helping people resource projects because of the market at the time post-COVID and talent and recruitment tools, leveraging the network that we had built were quite beneficial for our studios and businesses using the platform. So we were sitting there looking at our best users being graduates, thinking we need to build more tools or resources to help this kind of network of young professionals leverage opportunities. And so that's kind of, we always knew we needed something, but the grad program was essentially the first kind of iterations or versions of our ideas for
helping out the members. So
yeah, exactly.
In essence, if you were to describe Co-Architecture, it's essentially a bit like the LinkedIn for architects.
Exactly.
So a platform where people can connect and collaborate and get ideas. I think early on you had a lot, and you still have that on the platform of being able to find images and things like that. So essentially, what are the tools that designers need? How can we be useful? So you're going to Pinterest and looking for inspiration. Can we do that? If we are a business and we're looking, or a small practice, and we're looking to have a way of, you know, getting our designs out there to attract more people. And that's where obviously it's that. And, you know, when you start with graduates, people always have that short-term thinking, and I think that's great. You've got to work to the mixture. You know, in 5-10 years' time, they're not going to be graduates anymore. Yep. And, you know, that's where obviously what you're looking to do is provide a legacy. So from there, then, you know, we just sort of talked a little bit pre-coming on about sort of what were the focuses for last year and how the platform has evolved and what the focus are for next year. So you have, you do all of those programs. You've also got the Co-Architecture Academy as well, which you've just run, and we were part of that, of an accelerator program. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. I think the benefit of our platform is we kind of just get the nuances or the things that are industry specific. Like, we love LinkedIn. We're on LinkedIn, of course. We have a great network there as well. But the challenge is it's a global platform that potentially doesn't always cater towards our industry. And that's kind of our point of difference, is being a local business and a local platform. We understand the market, we understand the small things that make a big difference, and we can kind of action them quickly. And so, yeah, all those little tools on showcasing studios and practices and their brands and projects became part of our actual marketing strategies too, so that it started building their visibility. Following those tools, we were quickly realizing, because majority of the market are small businesses, it's always a sole practitioner or maybe two directors starting off and kind of turning from a side hustle into their main business stream. And not everyone had those formal training or MBA degrees and things like that behind them. And they were struggling to potentially leverage a lot of the opportunities they had available to them. So there's just this missing piece around business acumen or mentoring to help these founders grow. And because we were fortunate enough to go through business programs like the university alumni program, and then later we went through our own tech accelerator program as well, we knew those benefits. We saw firsthand how much impact they could have, especially if you have no industry expertise in software development or other, and how does it actually accelerate your own professional development and growth as a founder. So we looked and looked for those types of opportunities in our industry, and we're not the first to invent them. They do exist, but there wasn't really anything in the Australian market. And so we thought, how do we tailor and adapt a program that has the same kind of intent in helping founders, but just more focused on architecture and design studios? And so that's where our idea for a studio accelerator came out. And being a professional network, it meant that we already had a lot of amazing mentors and networks and supporters that would want to participate.
Yeah, so you had industry. You had essentially experts and topics talking. So, you know, we do HR, but we actually did a whole one on business and the concept of things like that. And then you had other people talking a lot about brand and marketing and those types of things, really helping businesses to establish, particularly in a, you know, you could call it, from purely economic terms, a commoditized market where there's lots and lots of people and not massive differentiations. How do you differentiate and talk to your ideal client and what they are? But also then, you know, being able to pair them to have one-on-one sessions as well. So meeting with people. What were some of the feedback and some of the things and the benefits that people found from that program?
Yeah, I think the biggest bit of feedback was definitely seeing how valuable mentorship actually is in business development and growth, not realizing how accessible it can be sometimes in connecting with those people. And so I think, because again, the industry is so fragmented, we often just work in isolation, and we can achieve so much more if we collaborate or if we support others and work together as businesses rather than individually. It doesn't need to be so competitive, and people can still benefit from that whole process. So I think, again, by building visibility and creating accessibility to those types of opportunities, which is a bit of a mantra of co-architecture, the biggest bit of feedback was just opening that up to people and then realizing they have it and have access to it.
Yeah, so connecting with experts to give them insights into things, but connecting with other people going through the same challenges or that kind of feeling, particularly when you're a business owner, of am I the only one going through this? Everybody is. And I mean, I think everybody gets a lot of benefit, and I've done this at different times through running a business, of having groups where you check in and just feeling like you're not the only one going through it or doing it. And sometimes people do have friends who are doing it, sometimes people don't, sometimes people don't want to share that information, but actually creating a connection where people can go through that. And there's learning. So I think you had people in the group. We did some surveys as part of ours of, you know, how long people had been running their businesses. I thought there would be more newly established. There was actually quite a few people who'd been running their businesses for quite a few years. Mm. And we're just looking at that different evolution, wanting to invest in that and think, okay, well, I can either stay here. I had a conversation with a small firm owner this morning, and we were talking about that, that there's probably what I see, and it's the same for accounting firms too, or lots of professional services. So accounting firms, for example, or bookkeepers, any of that sort of cohort, there's some really big, you know, you've got your Big Four, all those types of things, but it's actually made up of thousands and thousands of small businesses. And the thing is there is the same sort of approach within market. If we look at, you know, architecture, you're either talking to, you know, people who don't have knowledge, they're more residential, or you're talking to developers, or you're dealing with government. And then there's, you know, who the client types are. There's a lot more in that, so commercial businesses. But in essence, it's, well, the process of doing that is, yes, in brand and thought leadership, but at the same time, it's actually a very big spend, right? Like if we look at it versus you want to go and set up an e-store and sell socks, you're generally selling between 10 to, you know, even $1 million in fees. And it could be over a year and a half. But that's a very big purchase. So the marketing approach for it is similar. It's a similar process. In the same way for bookkeepers, it's very different. It's a similar process. So being able to kind of learn from each other in different things that we do, it doesn't mean, particularly if you're regionally, if you're in WA and you're collaborating or getting to meet with somebody or talk with somebody who's in Adelaide, you're not in, or if you've got a passion for hospitality, you don't really want to do, you know, residential, there's different things that you can learn and the pain points you go through. But in the same way, I find there's also a different size of firms as well, right? So we get firms that are generally, I'll put it in categories of turnover, you know, sort of up to a mil, they might be five, they bounce around. Then you've kind of got that next size of 5 to 10. Then we start to get to the size of 5, 10 to 15. Then we get 20 and above. And the actual amount of firms that are actually 20 and above is about 4%. Yep. Whereas 80 to 90% of firms actually sit under that, well, it's about 75 to 80% of firms actually sit under 10 people and will bounce around at that time. So one of the conversations I often have with people who are, you know, because we obviously come in when it's strategic, whether we're, you know, we do recruitment services, whether we're doing their HR, training development, generally strategic stuff as HR. What is it that you're looking to achieve? Because the people part of that is actually building the business up to the strategy you want to meet. You have to figure out how much and what, how big you want to be and what sustainability you want. Then you can work it backwards to work out what revenue do I want to be? How many projects do I need to do? Who do I want to be targeting? And the difference is probably, you know, somebody who's a business person who works in architecture, architects are more coming generally for the first place if I want to do good work and I want to do great design, and bringing that business sensibility or approach. And it is something that you can learn.
Definitely. I keep going back to the accelerator programs we were a part of, and it's kind of 101 stuff that anyone who's done a commerce degree or an MBA, it's like what they're taught every day is this kind of business modeling and strategy and planning and things like that. And then, have a five-year goal, work back from that. What does that look like as a pathway in there? So, that's been a big part of our learning journey. I'm an architect, so it's never been part of our training and education. Yeah. We're taught how to do projects and deliver projects. The business side of things is very, very different. And it just breeds this kind of industry of I think we've mentioned this before, but architects that say, I am an architect first and I happen to have a business kind of second, when it really should flip around that I'm a business owner first and I happen to create good design or good architecture. And I think that's a huge mindset shift.
Oh, absolutely. And we said this too in it. I mean, at the end of the day, and this was something that was said to me very early, because I mean, I've got a commerce degree, a law degree, a master's in business. So business is my love and passion and people is my way of doing that, right? I remember the founder and managing director or managing partner at the time said to me, you know, if you want to do good architecture, you have to run a good business. And it's 100% true, because if you do want to run a good business, you need to have good projects, but you also have to have a reliable team that's there to do it. Now, yes, that core team, you need some flexi, but at the end of the day, if you don't have a good business, and I've seen many people, good architects, have either had massive tax bills because they haven't accounted for that, the cash flow side of things, the business side has killed them that they haven't been able to do the architecture side. Or they've had to then go back into big practice. But there is a very, very mental heavy load there too. If your business fails, it's really, really hard, because you put your heart and your soul and you do everything into that. So I think the thing is that understanding that the business has to run. If you're not great at that, you don't need to be. That's why you have experts who do it and give you the information that you need, right? It's like, I'm not going to design my house because I'm going to get an architect to do it who, yes, I can go on to AI and I can find out and we can do a lot of those things these days, but they're not going to understand the nuances of how do I want it. And that's what the architects bring. And definitely, that's what using other experts also brings. You know, I had this conversation this morning, just a good bookkeeper, and you're very clear on the information that you want and when you need it, is exceptionally important. Very, very basic principles of like cash flow is absolute king, particularly in project-based businesses. And everybody in this industry has the same problem. For builders, it's 100 times worse, because they have to cover all of the labor costs and material costs. And, you know, I know people who are waiting for half a mil and they've got all this money owing out. It's a
place to be.
Well, it is. They've got a lot more. So you remember, everybody thinks the builders do make the money and they will continue to, but at the end of the day, they hold a lot more risk. But for architects, it's exactly the same way too. I think people thinking, oh, I've got $1 million fee. And it's like, well, that might be great, but when are you going to get billed for it? And so we talked about this, and we can talk about in this context of it's, I always approach it more as a buckets, right? I have a formula of how much you should be allocating per your income, depending on what you want to look at for your gross profit. And that would be based on your labor and your operating costs and what you want to make as your net profit. You need to actually structure your business to make profit, because if you don't have a sustainable business at the end of the day. What you do with that profit, great, give your people more bonuses, invest in better technology, whatever it is, right? But at the end of the day, you know, if you want to do that, you have to have your business continuing on. And the thing is that there's many, many architects out there, and there's many people in the industry who've worked with fantastic designers, but they're like, but I didn't get paid. And so it doesn't matter, you know, it's the number one rule. If you stuff up people's payroll, good luck. That's only going to go so far. And yeah. I think, you know, the new generation as well is just not going to put up with that. Like, you know, you might've got away with 40 years ago. That's not going to roll anymore. So I think the other factor I notice is in the industry is, you know, there's not many businesses who actually continue on to that next generation as well. So, and I often see this, you see a business kind of generally in architecture go for about 30 years and then drops off. And then people start to hit that sort of late 50s, 60s and start to think, oh, now what am I going to do? You know, that's one of the things we say, you've got to be thinking about your succession plan and those things. Whilst engineers generally try to grow, when you've got to remember they're based in numbers and they're thinking numbers, not in bigger picture, they're thinking, what do I need to earn? How do I do? And they generally sell out, because the profile of engineering firms is actually major, major international organizations and then a scattering of very small firms around, particularly in business services. Versus in architecture, there's only about 10 firms who are over 200. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a very, very different profile. So who would buy that business? It's not. So most of what, you know, I've known one client we had who sold out. They're in a very, very niche area. It was engineering, you know, they could for the engineering part and they had structure in that way and they're very smart about it. But most architectural firms do need that succession or that collaboration to build a bigger brand to use. And the interesting thing out of coming from an internal position and coming into the market, there is also a benefit in people creating brands and partnerships and JVs. We're currently doing a project for a client where we are, you know, doing a full executive search to look for partners in the market that they can partner with to strategically grow, to grow both businesses. And, you know, where that ends up long term may turn into long term partnerships and connections or not. So I think the platform is fantastic in that way and being able to connect. But at the same time, I think it's good what you're saying about having people not thinking about competition. It is very competitive, but how do we work together? You know, we just did a podcast with BKK purely on JVs and partnerships and how many JVs and partnerships they'd done, which is their main model, because they didn't want to be more than a certain size and take on that risk, but enabled them as architects to do a fascinating amount of different projects and different things. So what's your sort of take and thoughts on that?
I totally agree. I think a lot of the, I guess, let's say business mentors or senior business owners who've been in the industry for like the last 40 years, decades, they've kind of had the benefit of hindsight and seeing all these kind of changes across markets, economies and business structures and things like that. And when you listen to them and ask them about their experiences, yeah, all the things you're describing, they've experienced. And I think as an industry, it would be highly beneficial for us to learn from these things and talk to those business owners. And it's really the only way we can develop those business skills. You don't have to agree with their ideas or their strategies, but I think there's this one thing I picked up on very early in our experience building co-architecture in the startup ecosystem. It's so diverse and so different. Like we were going through these programs with companies that were trying to cure diseases or build med tech devices or, you know, like crazy outlandish, like Facebook style companies. And they don't relate to our industry, but there's still things we can learn from them and still things we can understand as a strategy and how we might adapt it and apply it to our own industry, our own market, our own customers and things like that. So I think only good can come out of that. And yeah, there is also that risk in our industry that if you put all architects and designers in one room, you're only going to come out with the same idea or the same solution. So I think that is currently what happens as well, is we don't
I
get
often
enough
say,
cross.
I mean, it's funny when we interview people, I ask them why architecture. Yeah. Right. If you wouldn't mind, can I ask you that question? Why did you want to do architecture to begin
with? Yeah, good question. I didn't actually, as I said, I didn't really start out in architecture in my career. I started out in engineering, and
what,
that was
what
a
type
logical,
of engineering did you do?
Civil design. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds design. It's not. I was working in the resources sector in WA, so it's mining and construction. I was young at that time. It's kind of like, I think your idea of a career is like, how do I earn enough money and how do I get ready to buy a house and things like that. So I wasn't really pursuing a passion. I was always someone very creative and quite abstract growing up. And I think if I had the right idea on what to do with careers, I probably would have pursued architecture earlier. But yeah, I think architecture is at this really nice cross section of being creative, I guess, maybe a little bit idealistic, but entrepreneurial. And those are definitely innate skills that I kind of feel like are things I have. And so it was a really nice pathway for me to follow.
It is that mix between the art and the science.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I often say I love working with architects because they're very, very big picture, but at the same time, they have to work through the smallest detail.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say out of all, the less pragmatic out of all of ours, but I mean, I talk a lot and are very esoteric too. So, you know, it's obviously a natural connection at times, but it's interesting working with different professions. It's interesting. Most people say, you know, they were creative and artistic, or, you know, get answers of, you know, I was told this is a way of me making money within artistic. And others, it was like, I loved art and science. I love making Lego. And there's different insights, but I would say there's a general sort of approach or mind that somebody who I wish I could be an architect and be that creative. You know, we often say that there's probably 5% of architects are the real designers. I would not have been that. You don't want to see my drawings. Horrific. But I do love reviewing folios half of my day and, you know, working with architects and this kind of part. I remember somebody early on when I started in architecture said that architects are humanitarians. They want to save the world and change things and make a difference for people. And I think that's the really nice thing that does undersit. Yes, you know, we've just talked about the business side and needing that, but at the same time, it's I want to make a difference. You know, generally, you know, it's great. I do a lot of work with neurodiversity and, you know, the interest is, oh, great, I want to learn more. You know, anything to do with always just nice. I mean, I've worked with engineers and I've worked in different types of companies too. It is how can we make sure everybody's happy? How is everything? On the flip side, there are places where you go, oh, hang on, this is not a workshop and, you know, a sweatshop. We do need to look after people. But I think the industry is changing that way.
Yeah, no.
On that, I mean, where do you see the industry going in the next sort of 10 to 20 years? What do you think is the future?
I think there's a lot changing. And I think, I mean, on a personal level, I probably would have stuck with architecture and being an architect and doing projects more if it was a bit more conducive to a career working within a studio. If I didn't start for architecture with my co-founders, I probably would have looked at starting my own studio.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have been something I would have stayed in another practice or studio. But given where we currently are as an industry in the Australian market, and it's kind of reflected across different geographic regions as well, not just Australia, but it is a very slow moving, mature industry, and there's a lot of legacy kind of structures and organizations that have a lot of, let's say, I think the industry puts a lot of emphasis into, which potentially I think could be better used on their own businesses or just doing things more faster, I think. And I know that'll ruffle feathers and things like that, but and I'm a card waving member of a number of organizations and platforms, and I'll always support them and things like that, but I think it's part of the industry being fragmented that we don't have enough representation across those areas. So I think collectively you could do a lot more together in your own rights, they're waiting for things to change and happen. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the market right now, especially just in housing and residential, right now there's record high kind of debt and inflation banks that all they're doing is funding debt across the Australian market, which the average house loan is sitting at around $850,000. No, most people can't afford that, and it's only going to keep getting worse, which means people's kind of discretionary incomes are going to come down. They're going to spend less, and investing in anything in general is also going to come down, which is not good for any market, let alone a major market like construction. And so I think what we'll see is a lot of moving towards renovations and less new builds, a lot of inherited properties and assets as well, rather than kind of earned wealth or income, and that changes the way people spend money and how they see money. And so I think in the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be a very different market of projects, and therefore potentially, hopefully, different types of businesses as well that try to address those markets and create solutions for them as well. So that's kind of my prediction of what I would encourage the industry to look at.
So instead of thinking this is what the market's been for the last 5 to 10 years, economically it's just been a bit tough, we're talking, you know, you're talking about economics there.
Yeah.
I think there's two other factors, you know, and I've had this from other podcasts too, and obviously our observations as well. You know, we live in a global economy. So global talent and being able to reduce costs, because at the end of the day, an architecture firm is, you know, income, labor, operating costs. That's it. It's really that simple, which makes it very easy. But at the same time, you know, it's how you're going to reduce those if the market and what people are willing to pay, which is obviously two ways. It's obviously looking at cheaper labor, how can I get that done for a less price, or how can I do it more efficiently? So either using technology, which may be, you know, investing in your Revit, BIM documentation, your processes, how everything interconnects. But now obviously is going to be the emergence of how much can be automated through further technological developments with AI, and the same thing within your business and what you're doing. I think the fundamentals still don't change though. You know, at the end of the day, as much as design is it, it is actually a people business. You are working with people, you're working with their desires. When you're in projects, you're working, if you're in larger projects in particular, lots and lots of different consultants with builders, getting things done. Those things do not change how the work gets done. And I think that we will see a progression. I think this next 10 years is the time for smaller firms to be able to compete a lot more, to be able to achieve a lot more. And some of that is it's just easier for smaller organizations to be able to be agile and look into things and invest. I mean, myself alone, we're about to go and do some stuff on AI. I literally am using every single AI tool out there to actually figure out what they can do and to compare them and figure out how does that actually work. But that will only continue to increase and to change over the next 5 to 10 years. The way that we work will change. However, the biggest problem is we need to make sure that we don't have slop and we don't have mistakes, and there is a human element in there to make sure there's accountability, because at the end of the day, the risk will still sit with the architect and that liability. So I think it will also be very interesting to see how, particularly with that and more emerging people come through, and I've had this conversation with multiple different directors across the industry, is how are you going to invest in graduates when they've been doing most of this, when this might be outsourced overseas for documentation, or when, you know, a lot of visualization, that's great because it's happening a lot quicker, can be done. But how is this going to look for graduates over the next 10, 20 years? How are we going to build the next generation? Because universities are very focused in Australia on the design side. You know, I used to think, oh, we've got to break them for 5 years again to building goes together and how everything actually works. But it's going to evolve, and how we then have, as you've said, there's a large generation of firm owners out there who will retire in the next 10 years. Yeah. It is exciting, as you're seeing from your cohort, is there is a lot of younger people coming in and starting firms, and they've got that desire and that energy, and they're using technology and optimizing it. And I think we'll grow, but they don't necessarily have to all be part of big firms. They can collaborate and piece together a bit more like a jigsaw puzzle. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be naive for a business owner to not accept or acknowledge AI, not accept or acknowledge outsourcing, and not accept or acknowledge the talent that's coming through as well. Like, these are all factors that influence your business, the market, and sticking your head in the sand is going to help. And so creativity and being a good designer is part of your business, is not your business. Yeah, I think having an awareness of those things and investing time and focus in them is fundamental. I would also, I think, like, if I can offer a perspective on what I think one of the main issues is in the current market, I think the dissonance that exists between project opportunities or clients and design professionals is they're just on different pages at the moment. And I think it's as simple as that. We have the hindsight of seeing and talking with all these homeowners around Australia, and it's not that they don't value design. They do value design. They really want to work with architects and designers. They really, really do. It's just that they're not being met at the table. And yes, some clients' budgets won't fit with your business or your business model and financial kind of strategies. And that's fine, but there's no kind of communication piece there that helps them figure out whether or not you're the right fit or whether or not they're the right fit. And instead, the people who are scooping that up and owning that market opportunity are actually people like builders. They're now acquiring in-house design services so that it becomes a full
DNC.
Exactly. Mm. And so that's been going on for the last 10 years, and no one's really approaching that, I think. You just have to look at builders. They've been doing that as part of their strategy for a very, very long time.
Well, I think the thing is, and you're somebody who is going through this, it's like, you know, I bought a house, it's sort of maxed out, but we know it needs to have things because, you know, nothing's affordable that looks good. and this is not affordable either. And then you go, okay, well, I've got this budget, this is what I can spend. At the end of the day, the budget is the biggest problem.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem is, you know, for the industry overall, is that there is not enough trades to be able to build things. So the trade costs are ridiculous. But that's a perception at the end of the day. Like, I think in 10 years' time, we may not think that. And obviously, the material costs have been very high. I 100% agree with you, because if we're just talking purely residential, because the biggest thing is, and that's what I like when with your approach, is, well, what actually is your budget? What can you actually afford? What does your mortgage potentially maximize out that you can do? Because that's the end point. And obviously, having worked in the industry, you know, I know roughly what the design and the consulting cost should be as a percentage of the build, because I work with architects and we know what their fees are and how they're structuring. But the hard thing is, it's then when you get it and you go, Jesus Christ, like this is very, very high. I know I have had conversations with some architects who are saying that building designers are killing them, particularly in the residential. And I can identify two reasons of why I think that is. One, they're quite pragmatic. And so they're coming from a case of, what do you need built? What is it going to, like, this is it. This is what we do. This is what the cost is. And I think that's been interesting. Even through your process, there were some people who were very clear, even on their website, this is what it costs per stage. Yep. And I was like, that's quite, as a business owner, I look at that and I go, that's the way you scale, right? You're quite upfront, or you're quite clear and you already have a clear process, because cost is probably going to be the biggest factor, because there is no flex. If we're just talking in renovations and houses, there's no flex in that. But the same even for commercial developers and builders. And this is where you'll find those people who work with commercial developers, that's how they think. And that's why they get the work. It's not just because they design beautiful buildings. They understand this is the block size that we need. They're starting to think like developers, this is the block size. This is what I need to optimize. I need to be able to sell it for this much to be able to make this, because they've got to go to the bank to actually get the money, to get the funding, or finance it out, to get the finance to actually build. It does come down to those limitations. And the hardest thing is the actual cost to build. So whilst we all want beautiful designs, it does cost, can cost a fortune. We had a designer who actually said to us, we'll do this, and we even recommend we even get down to the FF&E schedule to start with, because that's going to give you a good indication of what the cost is going to be per square meter. And yeah. I was like, that's the type of thinking we need, because at the end of the day, if we cannot build this, it might be the most beautiful design ever, but it's not going to get off the page unless I can actually get an architect, I can actually get a builder to build it, and they can procure those materials and be able to build it for this cost in this time that we need done. And that is the end point. And I think in the same sort of thinking of business people, in the same part, at the end of the day, it is money. Yes, you don't want to be determined by the money, but I think you will find that the architects who have the ability to be able to understand what the budget is and work within that budget, both from the fee but the actual project being able to be built, are going to be. And that's why DNC companies are doing it, because the design factor, they can do something. But the biggest security, and particularly in somewhere like Queensland, we find there's a lot of, or the industry sees a lot of novated leases.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, we get, everybody gets novated leases. God, can't get novated over. And that is because at the end of the day, they need to be able to know what is the cost going to actually be, whether people make it up in variations, another thing. What is the cost actually going to be, because the project actually can't get built without those costs.
Exactly. In building co-architecture, early in my career, I was very much of the mindset that good design is worth this and all these kinds of things, which is not bad. But I think after building co-architecture, because it wasn't related to projects and costs and things like that, in that sense, it kind of opened my eyes up to understanding that any design, whether it's architecture or web design, it's should be about creating value for your customer. And that doesn't mean it's aesthetics is one part. It might not be the most valuable part. Cost saving could be the most valuable part, and all these kinds of things. So I think going into that with the mindset of how do I create the most value for my customer is a successful pathway. You can't not succeed if that's what you do.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, in entrepreneurial terms, talk that product market fit. What's the value that you're going to be doing and things like that. Entrepreneurs talking to entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
I think that's where that sort of mind shift, it's just a practicality and a commerciality at the end of the day. Let's talk back to co-architecture as we sort of finish off here. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've got planned for the future and the focuses for the next year ahead.
Yeah, I think in terms of the future, as we just talked about, we've been watching a lot around how projects and the markets are shifting. And in the background, we've also been listening a lot to our members as well. So we're trying to understand both sides of the table, because I do think it's going to influence a lot around the tools and features and products that we try and build for our users. I think we really want to focus this year on just getting to know our members a lot more. So 2025 for us was a lot of early development on new tools and new products. And we had an amazing cohort of members who joined us that year to help us develop them. And a big shout out to them, because everything you see currently now in 2026 is because of them helping us co-design them and give us feedback. And it's amazing having early adopters do that. It's a good feeling when you kind of co-design and co-create like that. So I'm excited to kind of put a lot of emphasis behind that for 2026 as well. I want to really amp that up more and lean into the whole membership aspect of our platform.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about some of the features that you're sort of planning for 2026.
Yeah, definitely. When I summarize them in my head, they sound really minor, but they actually are quite significant, I think. But simple things like community aspects, we're building in tools and features that just allow members to submit things like ideas and tools and feedback. More visibility, I think. There's a lot that actually happens in the background that people don't see. And unless you're a user who's on the platform consistently, it potentially gets missed. So hence why we really want to focus on that. And I think tools on visibility, tools on marketing, promoting and building brand awareness, and then, of course, tools that help assist clients or project pipelines as well, that's up and running.
Great. Very exciting. And I think, you know, once you create a community and cohort, you've got something that can be tapped into. And, you know, I think the next tapping is obviously for people who are looking. And it is the hardest thing, because to find an architect is actually very hard. Yeah. Even though there's thousands out there, at the end of the day, people don't know where to go. And, you know, I've even suggested, even though I have thousands of architects sitting in my database and in my network, I still, you know, came to you to go, okay, well, let's see what's out there. How does this work? And I think some of the ways that you've shaped that has been quite useful. And I look forward to seeing how that digitally, you know, continues on to make that quite easy and a place for people to come. And I think that will be probably, you know, income is always the best asset for anybody as they do. The rest of it is all the add-ons into that. Okay, brilliant. Kevin, now, is there any books, podcasts, anything like that that you would recommend to listeners or anybody to check out?
Good question. I don't know if my guess is the types of things I read or listen to tend to be all business strategy and founder stories and things like that.
Well, we have talked about the importance of that. So do you want to share some of your favorite ones?
I've loved a few podcasts, particularly one of my, I guess, digital mentors or idols that I aspire around is Melanie Perkins, who's the CEO and founder of Canva. Just being a female founder, husband and wife team, and Perth, started in Perth of all places as well and grew there.
So what's the podcast called? Because I'm going to write it down.
Female founder podcast.
Cool.
I've forgotten it off the top of my head. Sorry.
I'll find it. We'll put it in the
search Melanie Perkins founder story. I'm sure if you go Melanie Perkins founder story, one of the pieces in there that she talks about, and this kind of goes back to the isolation of being a business owner, a founder. She followed a tech investor who came to Perth one year for kite surfing. She happened to meet him there. And they were looking for their initial seed investment to help build Canva and grow it. And so she followed him all the way back to the US, to Silicon Valley, to try and pitch to him and get his advice and hopefully his investment behind the idea. And he didn't straight away invest. I think he kind of said, let's make some introductions and kind of build the network and see how it goes from there. And it was like a 3-month process, essentially. But through that, she was kind of couch surfing in Silicon Valley, not sure what she was doing in America and all these kinds of things. And she wrote herself a thing in like a notebook that she had saying that it was kind of like self-encouragement. It was something along the lines of, it feels really shitty and stressful right now and things aren't working out the way you wanted them to, but I know who you are and I know that you will be resilient and you'll keep pushing through it, and it wouldn't be worth it if it were easy. And that she read on the podcast 12 years later, now being CEO of Canva, a $40 billion company globally. And I think that was pretty cool, pretty amazing.
And it is, even whether you have a unicorn tech startup whether you have $1 million business that, you know, that's an achievement, or $500,000 business, that's an achievement itself.
I just want to achieve 1% of what she's
exactly
achieved.
Right.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah. You know, so I think that's it. I mean, and that is life. And I think that's, I would say my advice to anybody thinking about starting a business is you have to be my ability to take on risk and the things that I would have worried about years ago, I just go, okay, we're just going to get on with it, right? Yeah. You have to be highly resilient, because one day it's going to be great and then the next day it's going to be shit.
Definitely.
And you're going to have highs and lows consistently. It's a bit like having children. Every day is a very interesting day. You think, oh, yeah, it's getting here. Oh, no, it changes again. And that is business. And I think that's where, you know, having cohorts of other people that are going through the same thing or have been through it or at different stages, whether they're in the same industry or they're in something else, is helpful. And I think having been an HR person and starting more from helping businesses, I've always been from the helping the business to succeed, for the people to succeed, and the people to succeed to help the business succeed. That doesn't change. At the end of the day, a business is a system, and each person in that system, it works really well when it's working well. If it doesn't, God, it's hard.
Definitely. Definitely.
That's not going to change, you know, what it's like dealing with the fact you've got a client doing this one second, this project's gone on hold. God, now what am I going to do to fill up for the next 3 months? How is this all going to equate? And I think the stress than an architecture firm faces or anybody in this industry, the stress is a lot different and harder than I think in many other industries. Because if you think about it, if you're Canva, you're based on subscriptions, you're talking about how many members we got, what's the lifetime value, all of that. If you're an architect, you're talking about how much have I got, how much are my billings, what's this going to look like, is this, and if a project suddenly just goes on hold, your entire pipeline's gone out the window. So you can go from being okay one day to not. There is an old saying, and I think this is the other thing I find. We've talked about business with architects, but the other part is it's actually the business development. It's actually getting the right routines to constantly be doing that. Now, you know, often people can find the clients and they just keep doing the same thing for them, and that's great. But at the same time, you probably never want any one client to represent more than 10% of your business if you want to work in average terms. And that means that it is that your part as the director is actually all the founder, whatever your role is in the business as the person who's running the business, maybe with somebody else as the other partner, your job is to mainly get work in the door, right? And so I think often what happens is people get into it to do the good architecture work. What we see people go through either in their careers, that they go from doing and getting to the architecture, and then suddenly they're going, oh, God, I'm managing people and I just doing admin all the time. And then it's they go through next evolution, I've got to be hunting and getting work in the door. When you start your own business, you go from being the person doing the work to being the person doing the work, running the business, getting the work in the door, overseeing and supervising other people, and especially for small practices, you're doing all of that and taking all of the stress home. And, you know, and the one holding all of the risk, because at the end of the day, you know, everybody else has the rights to get paid out and you've got to worry about that. But then you also have to worry about, well, what happens if I owe all this money, then what happens to me? And I think that's a good thing for any architects working in an architecture firm. Sometimes I think people think, oh, you know, the directors are just out and talking to people and doing this and doing it. It's like the amount of stress a business owner takes on and how much that they have to take on in risk and everything, that is what they're doing, you Definitely. Know, and it is like walking a tightrope where you could fall off at any point in time. And the great thing is I find that most business owners do first think about their people, right? Even when we talk to people who might be coming to the end of their career and they're thinking about succession, one of the biggest drivers is we've got a great team. I want to make sure that continues, right? We want to make sure that they've got the same thing we continue on, or I want to win great projects for my team to help them out with. And I think that is one of the great things about the architecture industry as well, is that the people who run the firms do in general really do want the best for the, and they want to go to work and they want to love the people they work with and they want to have fun with that. So I would say that to people coming into the industry or new in their career, you've got to realize that there's a lot of things that happens behind closed doors that you will never know. It's like ducks. It will look like it's, you know, and they need to, because they don't want to cause stress for you, but they go home at night and they've got to worry about, do I have enough money in the bank to pay the wages?
If that project doesn't 24/7 being a founder.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that, you know, I really hope as time goes on, the more and more people appreciate versus having a bit more of that, I go to work, I expect you to pay me. Now, that exists too, because at the same time, there is also all those people working their asses off to do all the great work and are actually generally the ones doing the design with the direction of the directors, and they couldn't do it without you. But I think it's just as important for anybody thinking about starting a business. It is great, but it's a massive risk. Or if you are working in a business, just appreciating that the people who are leading the business and owning the business are actually putting themselves at risk and on the line for you too.
Definitely. I think that's partly why I lean or gravitate towards that type of content and podcast, is because not only am I looking in terms of business strategy, but also just on a personal professional development level, like sanity checking and making sure like that I'm sense checking if I'm okay and if these are normal things to experience. And I'm very lucky I have two other co-founders that I can share this load with and whenever one of them is having a bad day, the others can step in and vice versa. So it's very fortunate. So
sole and I think that is the great thing about architects generally too, is some of the most successful businesses are actually the ones where there is more than one director.
Yeah.
And you all have a different, you know, I talked about this the academy of, you know, we might find there's three or four hats. There's the business person, there's the hustler or the work winner. There's like, now it doesn't have to be that formula, but, and then there's the quality assurance. And it doesn't have to be all in the founders, right? In the same way, I'm sure your founders all have, I think one's a tech, you're architecture, and one's done
marketing.
Yeah. Perfect, lovely combination there. It doesn't mean though, because if you're not great in one area, the most important thing you can ever do is to hire your gaps in and to find those gaps and find that complementary and enable those people, because, you know, quality assurance people, they freaking love that. They love the detail. They want to do that. They want to take the ownership of it. You know, you give somebody who's a naturally loves going out for coffees and hustling and loves that take, let them go do it, right? Enable them to do it, give them clear targets. You know, there's different things for different people. But if you don't have a business person, who cares? Get your bloody accountant, get a good bookkeeper, get a good, you know, strategic person. You know, we do this a lot with our clients too. We have 12 pillars within our sort of our HR. And one of those is the strategy and what are you doing and how you bring that. You've got to use good people to complement in the same way I've got an accounting background and I could have done my bookkeeping. And my first thing was, after getting my team to a certain size, my accountant was like, you need a bookkeeper. And I was like, oh, no, but I can do it. And then I was like, no, God, best thing I've ever done. Make exactly. sure I've got my bookkeeper. I just sit there and get my financial reports. I don't have to do too much. So it's one of those things that you can always, whether you found it or not, you can build that as you go in team. And then that frees you up to really focus on what it is. But it is nice if you have another co-founder or two other co-founders. Look, there's dynamics with that too. Means that not everybody agrees on the same direction, but it's nice when you're all, at least there's a few of you sharing the risk and feeling that. And I think if you are a sole founder and you're finding that you don't think that you're actually succeeding in that way, then use a network like Co-Architecture or use something else to maybe find something and actually merge together as firms that find somebody who's your yin to your yang and test it out. JV together, partner together on a few things, figure out if that's the way you mix. You know, I spoke to a firm the other day.
You can always go back to just doing it yourself if it doesn't work.
Well, yeah, that's right. And, you know, at the end of exactly, and you can go and do it yourself and do that. Or if you're fantastic on a certain sector and you want to get into another sector, you know, go and find somebody who might be already doing that and you've got that alignment. Yeah, I mean, that's where I think, you know, JVs and partnerships are great ways for people to be able to test these things out before they decide if they want to get in. But as I said, there's different ways in this industry. There is other firms out there that have one brand and share certain services, but they're actually independent businesses and they get kind of both of that. They get that network of being able to earn, but they also don't have to give their profit away. Yeah. And it's fascinating, you know, and I'm sure you and I both obviously have a very unique perspective because we talk to so many different firms and so many different people that we see how different things are done. And it's fascinating. There is no one way. And I think, as you've said too, what she was saying, it may not be great today, but you don't know what next year's going to look like or next month's going to look like. And anything that is a problem, solve it. Don't, you know, it's like an itch that festers or things. If there's a problem, analyze your business or what's going on, your strengths, your weaknesses, and then put a plan in place, right? And just put the list together of what has to be done and then just go down the list and start doing that. And I think partnerships are a massive thing that people should be, you know, thinking about further. Great. Excellent, Kevin. Sorry, we have gone on. That's been a very interesting discussion. Now, if anybody wants to get involved in Co-Architecture or sign up or find out more about it, where do they go and how do they get involved?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, whether you're a studio or professional working in the industry or the built environment, hopefully Co-Architecture can be a network and a support resource in that entire pathway. It's not a silver bullet to everything, but it's definitely a great place to connect and be a part of and help us build those tools and resources. Yeah. So coarchitecture.com is the best place to find us. Otherwise, hopefully you're following us on different social channels. Instagram and LinkedIn tend to be at some of our biggest ones, but it's free to sign up to our platform and email newsletters and things like that too.
Yeah, great. So sign up and you might as well. It's just another, worst case, just another email in your email box. It's probably relevant to you. But at the same time, also then you guys run events and things like that. So is there any upcoming events in the next few months, or how do people find out about those?
We have a few things launching in the next few months. We have a new design series, hopefully featuring at the moment local Melbourne architects and designers. That'll be due to launch next month. And then we also have an event series kicking off as well. So February, March will be our first event, and we'll try and get around to the different cities. So if you're keen to come down and meet the founders or just network and meet people who are part of co-architecture, then make sure you grab a ticket and come along to the next event once it's announced.
And nice to be in a room with other people with similar mindset and going through similar things. Excellent. Brilliant, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing co-architecture continue to evolve.
No worries. Thank you for having me, Sydney. I really appreciate you learning a bit about us and sharing our story.
Our pleasure. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye.
What a fantastic discussion we had with Kevin. We talked a lot about where we see the industry today, what we're both actually seeing across the industry, and where we see that firms can optimize to be able to grow and to hold their position for the next 10 to 20 years as well. This is a great discussion, and I hope you got fantastic things out of it.